All right, let's start. Good afternoon, my name is Gautam Thapar, and I have with me my colleague, Charles Lavana. We're from the Azure engineering team responsible for the Azure Resource Manager. Before I go start the session, just a quick show of hands of how many people have used Azure extensively. Okay, and how many of you have use the new preview portal or know about it? Very good. So do you guys know about the Azure Resource Manager? Some of you do. Okay, then it should be interesting. Today, I'm going to sort of take you through this new offering called the Azure Resource Manager, which is released at Build 2014. So it's been out there for a couple of months. But it's one of the more foundational changes that we've made in the Azure stack. And as you go through the sort of session today and the demos, you'll realize that we've not taken any shortcuts in the way we're sort of putting this offering out. We've pretty much re-gutted the entire management stack to sort of put an offering out there which makes a lot of sense for people, how our consumers build their applications and sort of deploy them. So today, for the next 60 minutes or so, we'll cover details about why we wanted to build the Azure Resource Manager, what has already been enabled since Build 2014, because the engineering team's been busy producing more capabilities as we released from the first version. And we'll leave some time for question and answers as well towards the end. So if I were to really, in a nutshell, talk about the problem that we're trying to solve with the Azure Resource Manager, It is about cloud resource management. And what I mean by that is, if you think about an application completely agnostic of the cloud you're deploying, whether it's on-prem or it's in the public cloud, it's rarely that your application comprises of a single resource. Most of the times, take a simple application like a website and a database backing that. Those are two resources that comprise your application. And most complex applications will have even more resources. So when you think about this application, you're deploying this application as a unit, not as a single resource. So when you talk about this application, management of that particular unit itself is not easy as it exists with cloud vendors today, like Azure or even other competitors like Amazon and so on and so forth. People who are familiar with using Azure already know that to deploy that application, which has about let's say four resources, it would take you four API calls to deploy those singleton four resources. And for obvious reasons, if these resources have any relationship between them, which I'm hoping because an application does usually, you will have to make some more API calls to stitch those resources together. A typical example is you have a website and a database that you've deployed. You need to take the database connection string and pass it onto the website and configure it so that they can play with each other well. So from a management stack standpoint, the platform leaves the onus of deploying these resources and stitching these relationships between them on you today. Whether you do it by making those individual API calls one after the other and then stitching up these resources together, or you write or you script it using things like PowerShell. But when you talk about scripting things using PowerShell, you have to now be responsible for all error handling and so on and so forth. All that logic has to go into your PowerShell scripts themselves. So it's not easy by any means. And that's squarely reflected in the existing management portal as well. So what you see is your resources deployed across all your applications categorized by the resource type in the left pane. Say you have four applications. You don't see an application-centric view. What you see is I have four VMs. I have three websites across all my resources. But that's not your application. So with the Azure Resource Manager, we wanted to produce a set of capabilities so that our consumers could take their application as they've conceptualized and deploy it into the Azure platform and manage it as a collection of that resource, as a collection which forms that application. So what we have to offer with the Azure Resource Manager is an application lifecycle container called the Resource Group. This is a container that hosts all your resources that have a common life cycle together. What we offer is a declarative solution for deployment and configuration. What that really means is instead of you making those four API calls one after the other, you're basically making one API call to the platform and saying, hey, this is a template for my application. Please go and deploy this for me. So the platform takes all your resources, forms a dependency graph, deploys them, configures the connections, and so on and so forth. And I'll show you a little bit more as we sort of go through the session. And then finally, a consistent management layer. As I explained before that we literally re-gutted the entire platform to actually come up with a management layer that makes sense, we wanted to be completely client agnostic. Whether you go from the preview portal, or you use Visual Studio, or you use PowerShell, or even go directly against the REST API, you are calling the exact same APIs with the exact same schema. There is no private APIs in the Azure Resource Manager. In fact, the new preview portal is built 100% on the public API. So if you decide to build a portal as rich as that, you can totally do so too. So let's dive in and talk about each one of these capabilities. Resource groups. As the name suggests, this is your lifecycle container for all the resources that make up your application. These are tightly coupled containers where you can deploy resources of the same kind or resources coming from disparate services. Going forward, every resource that you deploy in Azure must exist in a resource group. It cannot hang otherwise. So when we talk about this tight coupling, it's a slightly different take that we've sort of taken as opposed to some of our competitors, for example, Amazon. Amazon believes in a lot of loose coupling. You deploy your EC2 instances, for example, and then you basically associate them to a stack. If you delete that stack, there's no guarantee that all EC2 instances are going to be cleaned up or not. Whereas with the Azure Resource Manager and the Resource Group container, because the relationship is of a parent-child or for a containment relationship, you delete the resource group, it is guaranteed that it'll be every resource that exists inside it will absolutely be deleted. There's one of the common pain points that I hear from a lot of customers. In fact, one of the biggest customers I talked to last week itself were complaining about exactly this problem. To enable some of the HA scenarios as well, we wanted to make it so that a resource group could span regions. This is if you have a website deployed in West US, another one in West Europe, another one in East US, and you wanted to load balance between them, but yet the life cycle of that website is the same. All the instances of that website is the same. You want to put them in one resource group. So by definition, resource groups can span regions. So the resource group container acts as a unit of management. Think of it as a scale unit that you can deploy again and again and again. You deploy all the resources together. You update all the resources together. You get status rolled up for each resource in that particular resource group together. Any events that you actually go and perform, any APIs that you call for any resource inside the resource group, their events are generated and rolled up at the resource group level as well. What you get with the resource group is that it becomes a part of the identity of each resource that lives inside it. We identify each resource in the Azure platform by the Azure resource URI. And because the relationship is of containment, in the API, you will see the resource group show squarely up for every resource that it contains. Grouping, which is essentially to say metering, billing, status, everything in the new preview portal now rolls up to the resource group level. You can literally go in there today and see at a resource group level, what is it costing me today across all the resources inside it? And then finally, access control. The resource group also acts as a scope of access control. You can today spin up 10 resource groups having 10 distinct applications and then decide I want to give 10 separate permissions, 10 people separate permissions on those resource groups. Once you assign, let's say, an owner permission to a particular resource group, all the resources that exist inside the resource group, they inherit the permissions from the resource group. As we go through the session, Charles is going to talk a little bit more about the RBAC capabilities and show you how it's done. So hold your questions for that time. So as we were designing the resource groups themselves, a common question that kept coming up from customers is, how do we decide which resources go into a resource group? And the answer to that really is depends on you. As we talked to a lot of customers, we saw a gamut of sort of scenarios. For a smaller organization where you have the developer developing the application and also responsible for deploying it, he only wanted to deploy all the resources in one resource group because that's how the life cycle is for those resources. Whereas for a larger organization where you may have teams of people responsible for a function for a particular application, they wanted to control only their resources and not others. Examples, MySQL admin wants all the SQL databases to be in one resource group with a common lifecycle. My website admin wants all the websites in their own resource group with a common lifecycle. None of these guys have permissions on each other's resource groups, yet the websites have the ability to reference the databases and use them. So the platform allows for that. So the resource group adds that flexibility. It gives you the ability to model your application as you see fit. The next set of capabilities that we enabled as part of the Azure Resource Manager offering was the model-based deployment. It's a fancy term to basically say you can now templatize your entire application deployment. One of the cornerstones of the Azure Resource Manager was that we had to enable people to take their entire application and fire and forget to the platform. What that meant was, in this particular example that I'm showing you, I've written up a template, and that template is instantiating an application which spans across three resource types: a SQL Azure database, a website, and a virtual machine. And I'm also able to tell the platform in the template itself that there is some sort of a dependency between these resource types. For example, the SQL Azure database, the connection string for it needs to be passed on to the website. And the virtual machine itself, it depends also on the SQL Azure database. So when you submit this to the platform or the Azure Resource Manager, it's smart enough to figure out the dependency graph and make those 4 to 5 API calls for you as opposed to you doing it. You no longer have to worry about any error handling and so on and so forth because the Resource Manager handles it for you. If you were to do that using PowerShell, all your error handling logic would have to be built into the PowerShell commandlet itself, or your PowerShell script itself, rather. So templates ensure item potency. You can replay your templates again and again. You will get the same result. Think of it as source control. You take your templates, you check them in your source control. Anytime you make a tweak to your application, you deploy the template. It updates your application. You don't get new set of resources because when you deploy the template, you're telling us what resources you want us to touch. Each resource has a name. If you give us the same name as part of the deployment, we will refresh that resource. We will not go ahead and spin up net new resources.
Does the template have version control or history so you can see when it was changed and how?
The question is, does template has version control or history to see whether when it changed and so on and so forth? So yes, the template itself has a versioning scheme. In the template itself, you can say what the content version of that template is. In terms of the history itself, you can see the history of deployments that you deploy into a resource group. As far as history of when the template changed, that would depend on your source control, where you check it in. So you take a template, and then you instantiate that template into a resource group to get your resources. So if I took this template and deployed it into a resource group A with config A, I will get one instance of my application. Now think about it. In software development, you have your beta environments, your test environments, your production environments. The only thing they differ by is configuration. The definition of the application doesn't change. If you have a SQL database and a website, in prod also, it'll be the same thing. In the internal environment, it'll be the same thing as well. They'll obviously differ by the number of instances you have, you know, you've spun up and the config and so on and so forth. So all you have to do is take that same template, apply it with config B, and then you get a net new resource group which is representative of your production environment. Similar thing, for you apply with another configuration, you get your perf environment and so on and so forth. So This sort of enables you to repeatedly do your deployments of your application and sort of tear down your entire environments by just going ahead and deleting the resource group fairly quickly. With the Azure Resource Manager offering, we didn't want to really stop at just deploying the infrastructure. We wanted to get to a point where our consumers could deploy the infrastructure, configure it, and also deploy their app code inside the infrastructure once they're done. So pretty much going from zero to production ready with a single submit of a template. And how do we do that? Is by enabling a concept of extensions. We made the entire platform extensible such that resource types, like virtual machines, for example, can now ingest agents, for example, coming from Chef, from Puppet, and then you can run Chef recipes inside that particular virtual machine to configure maybe your IIS settings, to maybe install an antivirus agent, and so on and so forth. Similarly, on a website, I make it extensible by doing a web deploy package of my own application code onto it. For a SQL Azure database, I make it extensible by saying once the database is, the schema is created, go apply this DAC pack onto it. You can do that too. So the entire deployment, entire application, right from deploying the infrastructure to configuring it and then deploying your app code is completely modelable. That's a pretty powerful statement. None of our competitors do that. And in fact, by doing so, what we've enabled is not just the initial deployment of your application, but deployment and further updating of your application using templates themselves. One of the other things that we've enabled as part of this new Azure Resource Manager offering is a consistent management stack. And I touched on it a little bit before as well. What I really mean by this is, if you look at any layer in this layer cake, we strived for consistency for our consumers. Let's actually take the first layer, which is the Azure Resource Manager API itself. So if you're using Azure today, you may be familiar with the Service Management API, which you call to instantiate your resources. This Azure Resource Manager API replaces the Service Management API. But when it replaces it, whether you go from the Azure portal, from command line, or from Visual Studio, you're calling the same APIs. When you're calling those APIs, the schema for those APIs is JSON all the way, whether you're using it in a template or whether it's actually the API that you're calling. So from a customer standpoint, once you understand the concept, it just flows with you regardless of the client that you choose to call the Azure Resource Manager. Move down to the next layer in the management stack. Whatever we've produced in the public cloud with the Azure Resource Manager offering, it is our desire to produce the exact same thing and ship it for the hosted cloud as well as the private cloud as well. Again, I want to reflect on that statement. For your hybrid scenarios, imagine writing a template which spans your application across clouds now. You submit that template, and it instantiates some resources on-prem and some in the cloud for you. And that's only possible because of this consistent management stack that exists both on-prem as well as in the public Azure cloud. And then the next layer, or the last layer, which is the resource provider contract, we've essentially re-gutted the entire stack to say any service that is going to offer resources in Azure must conform to a contract. And that by that I really mean whether it's a first-party service, like which offers virtual machines, or a third-party service coming from the Azure Stores offering, like MySQL databases, anybody participating in that resource provider contract gets the functionality for template-based deployments, for resource groups, for RBAC, for eventing, and so on and so forth, for free. So from a customer standpoint, you can pretty much think of all resources that ever existed in Azure. Once they move it into this new stack, you can use them in your application, just like a first-party resource as well. So with that promise, what does this all mean for you guys? We give you an application lifecycle container for you to conceptualize your application and then deploy it into that application lifecycle container called the resource group, visualize it like that, manage it like that, and get status rolled up to that resource group level. We give you a declarative solution. You can model your deployments, repeatedly deploy them again and again to get different instances of your environment itself. That's also possible now. Go from zero to production ready with just a single submission of that template into the platform. And then finally, a consistent management layer, which gives you the same experience whether you go from tool A to tool B, whether you use language A or language B, exactly the same. I'll take you through some of the demos and show you some of the capabilities of the Azure Resource Manager offering. This is Visual Studio 2013. And as I said, we are investing really heavily in Azure Resource Manager. This is the only way that you will end up deploying resources in Azure going forward. So obviously, in Visual Studio, we wanted to first-class the experience of using Azure Resource Manager. If you wanted to actually build an MVC-based ASP.NET website, you would typically go file a new project, pick MVC application in the C# sort of tab, and then go from there. You do exactly the same now, but what you see is another option called Cloud App from the gallery. Let me name the project called TechEd EU, and then I'll hit OK. So what's happening now is that Visual Studio is reaching out to our Azure public Azure gallery, which is backed by these Azure templates that I described to you guys. And what it's doing is it's saying, hey, what all templates do you have available for me to actually go instantiate? So given that Visual Studio lets you create websites ASP.NET websites and projects of that sort, it's only giving you the option for websites and website plus SQL right now. In the future, you can imagine any and every resource that is going to be made available for cloud services, for SQL databases, for anything else, it'll end up showing in this particular list as well and to choose from. So for the demo purposes, I'm just going to pick up the website and SQL. I hit OK. So what's happening now is not only that is Visual Studio creating a framework for me to create my application or code it up, but it's also creating a framework for me to deploy this application into the Azure Public Cloud using Azure Resource Manager. So what you see quickly is your traditional framework of your application. You can now start coding your ASP.NET website. But what you see also created for you is another node called the TechEd EU, the project name .deployment. And it has a folder called templates. If I click on this template, you see a first class JSON editor right here, which is showing you this template that you will end up instantiating in Azure. Let me increase the font size for you guys so you can see. This is the Azure template pulled from the public Azure gallery, which will end up deploying your website and database into the public Azure cloud. Let me quickly go over the template for you guys so you can make sense of what capabilities exist with the template itself. A template has four main sections. The first section is the parameter section. And to answer your question, sir, you asked about versioning. You can see the content version on the top being the field where you can actually specify what version of the template you're using right now. So the first section is the parameter section, very self-explanatory. The author of the template basically wants the instantiator to provide some values. So he parameterizes certain fields. In this particular template, the site name happens to be parameterized. What that means is when I'm actually instantiating it, the tools that are sort of taking or ingesting the template will ask me for the site name. Similar thing for the site location. I want to deploy it in East US, West US, North Europe, and so on and so forth. So you have a bunch of these parameters that will go in the template itself. And in the parameter section itself for that parameter type, we have a couple of capabilities. We let you sort of the template author declare allowed values for validation, so you cannot just put garbage values inside the template itself. And then also the ability to define a default value, just in case as a user or as an instantiator you decide not to give in the value and just choose the default values. The second major section in the template is the resources section. This is where the entire meat of the whole template is all about. So what were you deploying? We were deploying a website, and we were deploying a SQL Azure database. So now, in my first resource section, I have a SQL Azure server. I've defined that type. I've parameterized the server location. And pay close attention to the properties envelope. This is all JSON, but this properties envelope essentially is telling me these are the two properties I need to successfully instantiate a SQL server. You provide these values, SQL server will be instantiated for you successfully. Going down, the next resource happens to be a SQL Azure database. Look at this specific construct called depends on. This construct lets me explicitly tell the platform that when you're deploying this particular SQL database, I need you to have waited for the SQL server to be instantiated correctly. Fairly simple. From a platform standpoint, this helps me build a dependency graph so I know which resource to spin up first and then go move on to the next step and so on and so forth. Again, for the SQL database, there is a set of properties as well which I need to fill in to successfully instantiate it. Again, JSON. Moving down, the next resource happens to be firewall rules. This is going to the point of I wanted to configure my infrastructure using a template as well. So now I can put firewall rules on that SQL server. Then I'm moving on to the website. I'm creating a website, and look at the properties of this particular website. I'm giving some details, but I'm also passing in the config as a sub-resource of that particular website and passing in the connection string. In the connection string, I'm using JSON functions like concatenation and so on and so forth to construct the entire connection string and pass it to the website. But I'm using a reference function, which is part of our template DSL, which lets me say, hey, from the SQL server that was instantiated or the SQL database, I want you to pick the fully qualified domain name once it's created. So this is an implicit dependency that I'm creating as opposed to an explicit depends on dependency. Two ways to do it. You continue down the entire template. There's a ton of other resources, but I guess you get the idea. So you define your resources. You define the configuration of those resources. Then you define the references between those resources. Submit it to the platform. We deploy it for you. So how do we do that? In Visual Studio, you right-click on this thing, and you say deploy to a resource group. Has a first-class way of asking you which subscription do you want to pick. I pick Visual Studio Ultimate. Which resource group do you want to deploy to? I can create a new one. But before that, I have actually, in the interest of time, filled in the parameter details for this particular project. So I'm going to just use that instead of the default ones right here. And I go back and I say deploy. I choose create a new resource group called TechEd EU. I choose the location to be East US. And I hit create. So what's happening right now is that a resource group was created in TechEd East US by the name of TechEd EU. I choose the deployment template. I choose the parameter file that I'm going to apply with it in the interest of time. And if I edit the parameters, you see this banged out field because this is a field that requires me to enter a password. So I need to enter this right now. I'll go ahead and punch in something. And I hit OK, save, and I hit deploy. So within the Visual Studio client itself, you can see in the output window, what's happening right now is that this template is being uploaded to Blob Storage and is being deployed using Azure Resource Manager. And when it finishes, what you'll have is a Windows Azure website and a SQL database, a blank SQL database created for you in Azure. So once this finishes, we will try to hit the portal and see how that looks. You can see it's actually telling you about each one of the steps, each one of the resources that were instantiated. It can take a couple of more seconds, maybe. Fingers crossed, everything going successfully till now. So if I go in the new preview portal and I browse for resource groups, I should start seeing this. I see this TechEd EU resource group that was created from the Visual Studio client. I hit that up. I get the resource group with a bunch of resources that were created, the website, the database. I click the website. I'm hoping it's completed by now. Yep, it successfully deployed the template. So if I go onto the website and I hit browse, it should actually open up a blank MVC application for me. Now, imagine this was just me clicking once and deploying a blank website and a SQL database. If I already had my application ready with me, coded up, how quickly would that happen? So to simulate that, I've already created an application called I Love Azure, and instead of now using Visual Studio, I'm going to use PowerShell and do exactly the same thing and show you what you get. But what I'm going to end up doing, though, is deploying to the same resource group with the same name and see what the result is. So the name I used was TechEd EU. I will say new. Let me increase the font so you guys can see. New Azure resource. No, resource group name. Use the same name as I used before. I give it a location. I believe I used East US. I pass in a template. Template file. It's in my demo directory called I Love Azure. I pass in a template parameter file. And for the purposes of the demo, I say verbose, and I ask it to force the deployment. I hit enter. Two things happened. One, PowerShell looked at the particular template and said, I have a parameter file for this. You've already defined some parameters. I'm going to use them. But this template also expects me to give you more or expects more parameters because I actually built my application, and now it's going to end up doing a web deploy. That web deploy requires me to actually have a username and password. So it's asking me for an administrator login password. I say, it asks me for a web deploy username. I give it my name and a web deploy database password. Notice that the password is completely abstracted from you. You don't see it. The way we were able to do that is in the parameters itself, this is a parameter of type secure string. It tells the platform, take this parameter, use it, but never log it anywhere. Once it's been used, trash it so that it's never to be saved anywhere in our system, anywhere in our cache. I hit enter. So what's happening now is that PowerShell validates the template. It says looks good. It's taking the same resource group that I already created, but now it's actually creating a deployment and deploying the resources inside it. Same template. I have a website and a database. The only difference being that I have an actual application that I'm going to end up deploying in this thing. So this is actually deploying all the resources for you now. The same experience that you saw within Visual Studio, the exact same experience you're seeing in PowerShell as well. This is what I was alluding to when I talked about the consistency. So it's deployed successfully. What you see is the same set of resources that were created are created now. I don't have two servers. I only have one server. I don't have two databases. I only have one database. So once it's deployed, let me actually try to go back into the website and try to refresh it and see what happens. There you go. The same website now has my application running on it with a single click of a template. Go for it.
What happens during deployment? Does it take down everything?
The question was, during deployment, does it take down everything? No. It doesn't take down everything because we're guaranteed to be idempotent. You specified that you're using the same resources that were deployed already. So the platform and the providers underneath are smart enough to say, let me do a diff of what exists right now versus what is new. So the only thing new was the web deploy package. So it just basically went ahead and applied that. I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
Going from
does it work for Visual Studio Online? This experience that I showed you, this experience itself, so the question is, does this experience work from Visual Studio Online? No, this experience itself doesn't work from Visual Studio Online, but Visual Studio Online participates in being a resource provider for Azure Resource Manager. So you can spin up Visual Studio Online accounts as part of a template, as part of your deployment itself. The question is, can we nest resource groups within a resource group? No, you cannot. We don't have that capability today. In the interest of time, I'm actually going to move over to Charles because he has some really cool stuff to show you with the capabilities that we've enabled, and we can take questions after, you know, some of the stuff that he talks about. Charles, take it away.
Thanks, Gautam. So something Gautam talked about earlier was the common set of management capabilities that we now expose as part of the Azure Resource Manager. And there are three big ones I want to hit on and cover kind of in depth and give you a quick demo of. The first one is the new centralized auditing of management operations that we offer, which basically means whenever someone creates or updates or deletes something, we actually record who, what, and when. So you can kind of go back and actually generate reports from a compliance point of view or just trying to debug stuff in your Azure subscription. We also have exposed the new tagging capability, which allows you to associate key value pairs with any resource that's offered within Azure Resource Manager. You can also use these same tags to actually run queries, filters, and generate grouped reports, that type of thing. And the third and final piece is the new RBAC capabilities, which is a new permission model that we've released last month, which allows you to grant highly granular and specific permissions, like make people read-only admins for your subscription instead of the incredibly powerful co-administrators we have today. And in order to kind of get these new capabilities, the Azure service you use must be supported through Azure Resource Manager. We're in the process of bringing all existing Azure services over. We have a few dozen already moved over, like the big ones, websites, SQL Azure, virtual machines, storage accounts, so on. And there's a couple that are left, like mobile services or like BizTalk. But we're in the process of bringing all of these over to get the full set of capabilities, and you can expect that kind of in the coming months. So kind of jumping into that first one. When you look at the audited events that we actually record as part of the platform now, each create, update, and delete, you'll see appear in these common views throughout the new preview portal, in addition to being available via PowerShell. And they give you very rich querying and filtering capabilities. So this is a very common ask is, who deleted that VM? You can actually go write a query against the event service or to get the audit log to actually see which user was responsible for deleting a particular VM in recent history. You can even do more comprehensive reports. Like we just released something on MSDN, which will basically generate a report to tell you who's added new admins in the past month and who's deleted admins in the past month. And you can basically run this and get a good view of all those operations that are happening. And in the preview portal, we really focus on three main filtering views and kind of going back to the new concept Gautam covered for resource groups, which is you can see all the events in your entire subscription, or you can go to a particular resource group and see all the events within that have happened to resources inside that resource group, or even on a particular resource, like at a website, to see who's started and stopped it, or who's done a VIP swap and that type of operation. If you kind of drill into these events, they're very, very rich and incredibly verbose. So in this example, we have not only the user that actually was responsible for doing it, but also why they were able to do it based on kind of the authorization based on RBAC. And we also kind of capture things like IP address and all kinds of other metadata so you can actually figure out who's making changes to your subscription. Also, a new feature that we've kind of exposed as part of this is something called the correlation ID, which allows you to kind of to link together these different audit events that map to a single logical action. And the reason we need this is the new capabilities like the resource group delete or the ability to submit a template. Because those may generate several different activities. You may have 50 or 100 or 1,000 resources in your template, which will generate 1,000 audit events. But they'll all be linked together based on a correlation ID. And you can use this to kind of see a more comprehensive view kind of as you start to get at scale. The second thing, the big thing, is these resource tags. So what these allow you to do is associate just a name value pair with any single resource or resource group. And the actual key of these tags, the name, can be up to 512 characters, and the value can be up to 1,024, which means you can actually put very robust or extensive information in there kind of as you see fit. Another part of the tags is that we have a subscription-wide taxonomy, which means we have a single place where you can go and see all the tag key value pairs used in your subscription, but also the admins can publish a set of tags that they recommend that the other admins on a subscription use. And this is really important because if you imagine you have a few hundred or a few thousand resources in your Azure subscription, you don't want people tagging with all kind of different patterns and paradigms. And instead, you can actually go and set this taxonomy up front. And this kind of filters down into all the different clients we have. The best example being the portal. You'll see autocomplete based on taxonomy, that type of thing. And kind of as a note, which is the number of tags you can have per resource or per resource group is only 15. This tends to cover all your mainline scenarios, but that means you can basically have 15 different views for a particular resource, and that's a number that we're going to keep working on increasing. Kind of as we work with customers since we released this over the past 2 months, kind of we've been tracking some of the more common patterns and practices. I just captured some of them here. The first is notes. This is a very common ask people have, which is when I create, a website or a database, I want to be able to note down why it exists, like why I created it, what it's for. So when someone sees it in a month or two, they don't go delete it, and they can kind of get that context without talking to the admins. The other example people do is they actually put the creator. So for example, when I create a website, I may say the creator is Charles. That way, say Gautam is a co-admin on my subscription. He goes and looks at it. He knows that I created that database. And doesn't go delete it without talking to me first. And another one which is becomes more relevant when you have the very large Azure subscriptions, and that's the department or cost center that you actually can tag each individual resource or resource group with so you can generate reports to basically charge back. So you can say department is marketing or finance or project greenfield engineering, that type of thing, which gives you the ability to quickly figure out and slice and dice the various cost information or the actual resources that are provisioned. And kind of the last one, which you see pretty frequently based on the templates and a lot of the functionality in Azure Resource Manager, can be the environment. So I can go tag, say, my websites or my resource groups specifically as being for pre-production or dev test or my test environment for prod and so on. And you can get an easy view across all of your applications to see those different environments. And this is a little bit different from how you use resource groups. And which is kind of why we put together material like this to kind of explain when is resource group the right container or grouping to use and when you should be using tags. For resource groups, as kind of mentioned several times, is they're meant for very tightly coupled resources, which means you deploy them together, you update them together, and you delete them together. And each resource can belong to exactly one resource group. Whereas tags, on the other hand, are very loosely coupled. You don't update things based on tags. Like, you wouldn't update all your VMs that belong to the finance department. And you use these tags to basically generate the views of what's out there. That may cut across applications, basically anything that you want to actually generate the views. And since there are other 15 tags, you can have a single resource belonging to up to 15 different tag views. And kind of these two concepts are what we're really pushing forward as part of the new preview portal, as well as PowerShell and the cross-plat CLI tools, basically is how you should organize and represent the relationships between your applications and the different components contained therein. So the third item, just the last bit of slides before we go to the demo, is about access control or RBAC. And this was released in mid-September. And this allows secure access to very particular and very granular resources and resource groups. Not only can you, say, grant someone only permission to a single VM, you can also choose to only grant them read-only access or grant them the ability to do full read-write, but not the ability to add new admins. And this high level of granularity is kind of what's required for large-scale deployments and very common requirement from our customers. And kind of it's great to get that out there available as part of the Azure Resource Manager. And another great piece of as part of the RBAC work, a little tangentially related, is that we now support admins done via users or security groups or service principals. And all three of these concepts just use your existing Active Directory. So if you have a normal security group for your source control or for your developers, you can reuse that when you actually grant permissions to your Azure subscription. Additionally, service principals now allow you to use the same type of Active Directory service principal concepts instead of having to use the individual management certificates like you do today with the existing service management APIs. Kind of to really get that easy to use, we've released a bunch of built-in roles, which kind of if you go to the new preview portal or PowerShell, you can quickly assign people to these. And there are three of them right now. That's the owner, which is full, just like a normal administrator today. There's a contributor, which is full read-write, but you can add new admins, and then there's the reader. And you can basically use these at any of those different levels. And kind of when we walk through RBAC, it's really there's only two key concepts to understand. The first is the role definition. And what a role definition does is it defines a set of permissions represented by that particular role. Something like a reader means you can only do read actions, that type of thing. And a given role definition can be reused many times. Basically, it makes it easy for you to normalize the relationships between admins. And you can do things like use the reader role definition at several different resource groups for a single user. The second big concept for RBAC is what's called a role assignment. And all a role assignment does is it takes the role definition, a given identity, which would be user, group, or service principal, and binds it to a scope, where a scope could be at the subscription, resource group, or resource level. It basically is what actually grants you access. And it doesn't contain any set of permissions. It just references the role definition, which makes it very easy from a governance point of view to just look at the role definitions versus the assignments. And kind of an important piece of the assignments is that they always are inherited, which means if I make someone an owner of a subscription, that means they're also an owner of all the resource groups and all the resources contained in that subscription. And this inheritance is very important, basically, as you start dealing at scale and partitioning up your subscription. Kind of a good infographic we have that represents this can be seen here. You can see, basically, at the top level, you can assign people owner, contributor, or reader, whether it's a user, individual users, or groups, at the subscription level, and that flows down. You can then be even more specific and use the same set of role definitions or the same roles at the resource group level, and that would just then again flow down to the resources, but wouldn't give you access to all the resource groups. And you can do one or many different resource groups when you're actually granting permission. And then kind of the last and the most granular is at the resource level, and you can kind of reuse, pick and choose the same type of assignments. And what's really interesting, we found out for something like at the resource level, if you're debugging something with somebody, you can just grant them access to, say, just the website, and they can actually see it, your website config and your various settings, but they can't see anything else in your subscription. If they log into the portal, they can't see your databases, they can't see your storage accounts, they can't see anything else, just the website. So this makes it very easy, basically, to have people get temporary access that's very limited and then to take it away later. If you look at the very raw details of the role assignments, is we use something called the scope, and this actually matches the resource URI or resource ID that Gautam mentioned earlier. And basically, it's much like a file directory path. If you grant someone permission at the subscription scope, that means they get access to everything underneath that particular path. If you give them permission at the resource group scope, it's everything underneath that resource group. And if you give them at a particular website or something like that, or a database, it's for everything underneath that as well. And basically, that's the core building block for how you actually choose where you're getting permissions assigned. And with that, I'll switch over to the demo. So this is a new preview portal, and I'm sure most of you are familiar, as we asked earlier. And what you can see is on all these different UI elements, we call them blades, we have a new thing called the events. And this maps to that auditing capability that I was talking about, the first of the three. If I click on this, I can basically see all the events associated with this resource group from the past week, just basically a pre-canned query we have. And you can see, there's stuff like I'm backing up a website, I'm updating a Redis cache configuration. You can basically see all these operations that are being done. And you can see also, we actually have two different users. I mean, these are both me, just for purposes of the demo. But you can see that one caller is based on that outlook.com address, and the other caller is actually based on an AD user that I created within my directory. And you can actually track all of this down. Kind of in the full example here, too, you can see whether or not the operation actually succeeded. So you can also use this to see if someone attempted to do something and it failed, we also even have an audit trail of that. You can see the particular operation that's being performed. And this is what I mentioned earlier about the authorization context. This is more important now that we have the RBAC capabilities, because it will tell you why someone actually is able to perform that action. Before, it's easy. You're either an admin of the whole subscription or you're not. But now that won't be as intuitive. You could have permission just because you're an owner of that website or an owner of that resource group. Being able to actually see that in the trail is very important, kind of if you're wondering why someone is able to do something that you didn't expect. And you can see we have also like even more just basically like raw debug information if you're interested. So like in this case, you can see that the actual configuration failed because a dependency is missing. And this type of information can prove to also be very useful when you're debugging template deployments or anything else that you're actually trying to do from PowerShell or API, because the error messages will be captured here for later. Kind of the recurring theme of all these demos is that anything you can do in the portal, you can also do via PowerShell or raw API. They're all available on MSDN. So for this particular example, we have this command called get Azure resource group log, which will basically you provide a resource group name. I'll use the one that I had pre-created. And it will basically fetch back all of these different event service entries. And you can use this command or API to do all those different queries that I mentioned earlier, like track down who's actually doing deletes or who's adding new admins, that type of thing. It's pretty messy here, just because PowerShell doesn't do too well with like big load of data like that. But if I do, say, like a table form, I can see basically who did what in the past week. And I think I've submitted a couple templates, so you'll see those show up kind of when this call comes back. Yeah, so you can see basically a bunch of different operations like updating a hosting plan for a website, updating the website itself, updating alert rules, are all basically being recorded with all this detailed information. And if you don't filter out the table, you can do all kinds of great parsing on it to see who's actually making these changes. So that does it for the audit events, but I'll switch over to tags. So kind of as I was talking about earlier, is tags give you a great way to actually filter all your different views and view your resources. Let me close that out. Yeah. So here in my particular subscription that I prepared, I have a set of various tags, say application type, conference, or department. I use the conference one, just I actually tag resources. You go to build, conference, TechEd, North America, TechEd Europe, you can actually tag it with the conference. You can go back and actually see where resources you created and are still sticking around from those particular demos. So for example, if I go to the TechEd Europe one, I have a bunch of resource groups, a bunch of websites, a cache already tagged with this particular conference. And I can kind of quickly navigate around using this. I can quick get to this resource group view. I can go to the cache. And since the tagging experience is so consistent across the platform, you don't really hit any sharp edges if you use this as your management pattern. And what's great, too, is even if you're not using the tag view, say I come from the resource group view, the same principle applies. Tags are always going to be visible on each one of these blades that we call them right here. And the tags that you actually have on it will appear kind of inline text really quick. And you can always click on them and actually find the related particular resources. So I can say click on this and see all the resources that are associated with TechEd Europe. And this is very similar to, say, what you do is if you click on the resource group, you see all the resources that are inside the resource group as well. And kind of these two pivots allow you to very quickly move between all these different resources. So as an example as well, you can quickly, to show you just how the taxonomy works, say I have this Redis cache, which is that new cache service that's GA'd fairly recently. I can come in here and start typing. And the autocomplete is based actually on that taxonomy that already exists. You see department appears. And you can create these even if you don't actually have any resources tagged with it. And then I can come in and choose to say, make it belong to the finance department. And that's because that, again, is from the taxonomy. So if you go up front, you can actually set up all these key value pairs that you want your customer, want your other administrators to use. So if I come and say do finance, it'll show up. And just like as whatever, it's adding it here. And then if I go back to the browse view and look at all the resources that are associated with the finance department, you'd see that this Redis cache would start to appear there. And again, switching over to the PowerShell, you can see the taxonomy very easily from the get Azure tag commandlet. And what this does is it actually goes out and it fetches all the different tags that your subscription has. The portal spans subscriptions, PowerShell doesn't, and that's why there's a smaller list. But you can see I have three things with a department on it, eight with the conference tag, and two with an application type. And then you can quickly do something like say I want to see the breakdown of resources, all different types of values for the conference tag. So I can see that I have six for TechEd Europe, one for build, and one for TechEd North America. And basically by getting this all up view, you can very quickly see what type of resources and what you actually have deployed based on those key value pairs you've created. And kind of if you're setting this up beforehand, you can do something like this. I can create a new Azure tag, which will be visible for my entire subscription and all my other admins right from the beginning without actually putting it on a resource. And you can kind of keep going down and even do stuff like the actual value you recommend. And the same thing would happen. And so for larger customers we've been working with, they'll actually go and establish this very robust taxonomy based on, say, the 5 or 6 tags they want everybody to set up, and as well as the set of recommended values for all those different tags. And it's not just about that. Basically, all the existing command lines we have for doing queries now support a tag option to basically fetch, say, the resources with a particular tag. So I can do something like give me all the resources with a department tag. And this will actually do a quick query to the server and give me all this information back. And you can go, you can see that in this example, you have the cache kind of that we were looking at earlier. It shows up here because it already had the Techhead Europe tag. But you can also do stuff like based on a particular value. So if I say do finance, it'll fetch all the resources that actually have a finance tag. And that kind of gives you a lot of different options to quickly fetch back information. And this same filter applies for both resources and resource groups. And if you do any of the read views as well that we already have, you'll actually see the same tag showing up. So if I say just list all the resource groups in my subscription, you can see right here the tags are going to be featured pretty prominently. So what you can do is you can say list a particular resource group, find the tag associated with it, then quick run a query to go fetch all the different resources or resource groups that share that same tag. So kind of that workflow is now made very simple by this new tagging capability that we've released. So kind of the last and the third thing I want to demo is really the new RBAC capabilities. So in this example, I have that same resource group I've been using for all the demos. You can see there's a new part. This is what we call these things at the bottom of all of these blades. Just like the audit record, we now have this thing, and you can actually go see all the different admins associated with this particular resource group. So if I click on the big one, I can see there's one contributor, which is a user. This is Kevin, is a guy on our team. And I can also say, look at the reader. And this is actually a group. And this is an example of a security group. And if I want to see who's actually getting permissions by the security group at this point in time, you can always drill into it and actually see the members. So in this case, I assigned a reader permission to this resource group, to the security group, which includes this particular user, which is also me, but just a different account. And what I'll do is I can show you on the flip side what that experience actually looks like. So say this is the Charles AD. If I switch over here to Internet Explorer, where I'm logged in as that user, you can see the same user here. If I go to something like Browse Resource Groups, I'll see this resource group and two other ones that I've already done RBAC permissions on as well. But if I click on it, all the buttons are kind of missing. I can't delete it. I can't add new things to it. And that's because the portal is kind of able to actually query an API, which we expose, which indicates that the user is unable to perform any of those non-read-only actions. And kind of how this person only sees the 3 resource groups for this subscription, the Visual Studio Ultimate with MSDN. Whereas if I switch back to the other account, which has full permission to the subscription, it will actually see about, I think, 8, 9 or 10 different resource groups associated with the same subscription. And that's kind of what's great about RBAC is it not only does it actually limit the permissions that you get, but it also completely filters out information so that if the other person logs into the portal or uses PowerShell, those resources to which they don't have permission don't even show up. But kind of an important part of that as well is kind of that inheritance that we talked about earlier, where if I give permission at the resource group, you automatically get it for everything inside of that resource group. That same thing would apply for, say, the website in this resource group. The same group, if I scroll down to the same part, I'll see that the reader is showing that TechEd Europe demo is still given permission to this website in that resource group. And it has a little note that it's actually via inherited as opposed to assigned explicitly at that level. This will kind of give you an idea of how everything's piecing together. But since this user on the other account actually has read-only access to the resource group, I could choose to give them read-only access to all the resources, but then go pick 1 or 2 that are important and give them read-write access to just those resources. And those actual 2 different permissions will play together very nicely. So as this example, if I'm back, this is back on the account that only has read-only access. if I say click on this Redis cache, I don't have any additional permissions assigned to it. And you can see I don't see any of the normal buttons like start, stop, or scale up here. I don't see any of those normal buttons. But also I have things like the keys, which necessarily aren't necessarily in actions, but the keys for Redis are going to be read-write. So we don't want a reader to have permission to those as well. So those are also denied if you only have reader permissions. Kind of this UI being very aware makes it very easy and intuitive to give the people this read-only access. So they don't go click and then see a failure. But in this case, the user has separately been assigned read-write access specifically to this website. And that's why you can see the user actually sees all these different actions to start, stop, and swap, and delete whatever they want to the website because they have permissions assigned that basically override the inherited read-only permissions. And basically, when we do when we evaluate whether or not someone has access to perform a particular action on a particular resource, we basically do a union of all your permissions, which is how you can basically have your reader capabilities augmented by being more granular read-write access. And kind of you can see something like if I click stop, that'll go through and work. And so all of these RBAC capabilities basically extend all the resources and service types that are available via the Azure Resource Manager, which includes virtual machines, storage accounts, basically all the heavy-hitting services that are more widely used that are all visible, say, in the management portal or via PowerShell. Again, similar. So to make sure, it was a question, do you have the ability to assign the roles to the same user? Yeah, so I think the question was, can you reassign the same roles to different users or groups basically throughout the subscription? Yep, yeah, so all the role definitions can be reused. With all those different types of service identities, like a user or a security group or a service principal. And you can actually reuse it, even for the same user at different levels, throughout the entire subscription. And it's kind of how, for this particular demo, we were able to show that the user had reader access at the resource group, but read-write access at the particular resource. Kind of get an idea via the commandlets. We have the get Azure role definition, which is that first concept I talked about when we were going through the slides for RBAC. This returns back all the different role types available to you. Here you can see the contributor, owner, and reader options. And what they actually talk about are, as you can see, the actions and not actions that are being granted. The owner gives you star, which means everything, as does the contributor. The only difference is the contributor has this not action over here, which means that you can't actually do assignment of new administrators or anything like that. And then kind of if you look at the reader, they only have */read, which means they only have the ability to do all the read-only actions that are offered by the Azure services. And now that you have RBAC at all different levels, it gets a little trickier to actually see who has permission where. So we have the same commandlet to basically get the Azure role assignments to see what identities have been assigned these permissions. And this will actually scan the entire subscription. So you can do something like this. And this will actually go to the server and pull back all those different admins that have been assigned. And you can see basically these are all owner assignments to these particular users. You can see what the scope is, where they've been assigned. In addition to contributors and readers versus owners. And this one's a little bit better if you don't do the table mode. But you can quickly go through using this command to get an idea of who actually has access to your subscription and to what degree their access extends and where it applies. I'm going to choose an easy example. You can see that this is a contributor permission to this particular user at the scope of an individual resource. And another great part about the PowerShell is that it's very easy for you to actually figure out how to go and grant permissions to existing users or groups or service principals. So if I say do get Azure AD user, I can basically see all of the users in my directory that are available for permissions. And this is baked right into the Azure PowerShell commandlets. So I can see all of the users that I have. Similarly, the same commandlet exists to view all of the groups. And what's really great is these are the same users and groups that are available in all other Azure Active Directory offerings. So if you, say, use Office 365 and you have groups that appear there, you can reuse those same exact groups for Azure permissions, which really, I think, simplifies your life quite a bit. And for people who have onboarded and already moved to the cloud for their Office products, it makes it very seamless to start using Azure. And kind of, you can also, basically, you have the full set to view all the possible entities. Like, you can even say view the membership as well via the commandlets. Kind of the last identity type, which is pretty important, is that of service principles. So service principles are basically the replacement for management certificates. So you can go out and create an identity and then associate multiple different forms of credentials with that identity, which can be certificates or keys or secrets. And then that identity is what actually connects and is what's actually being authorized. The benefit of that is you can very easily roll your certificates and your secrets without having to go update your management permissions. And kind of, if you have like a service identity that actually interacts with other things like SharePoint Online or Exchange Online, you can reuse that same service identity now to talk to Azure, which kind of is a great way to see how all of our cloud properties are starting to collaborate together. And kind of just as the last PowerShell commandlet, you can choose to do a new Azure role assignment. And to do that, I probably want to pull up one of the users that, and if I say new Azure role assignment, say role definition name, say I want to make an owner at the resource group of TechEd Europe, and choose the object ID of one of these users. And it doesn't always have to be object ID. You could also use, say, the actual principal name or email address. Those are all supported in the same commandlets. So this will run, and basically, this person were to go log into the portal, they would immediately be seeing that this particular resource group, and they'd be an owner on it. They'd be able to deploy new resources in it, to delete it, and all of that. And kind of that's a very easy way for you to script or automate the addition of administrators to your Azure account, which I don't know if people have tried to do it before with the existing management APIs. You don't actually expose an API to add co-admins, but all of these are publicly available today and can be called via PowerShell or API or SDK. And that really does it for the demo. And so I'll switch back over to slides just to close out our session. And kind of to recap what we talked about today is we really went through the Azure Resource Manager, which is the next generation of Azure management. And as part of that, we exposed the new Azure Resource Manager templates, which allow you to have a declarative and repeatable and predictable way to deploy resources in the cloud. And this same capability is what we're going to extend just like all of our offerings for both the cloud and on-premise, as Satya and Scott Guthrie have committed to very publicly. We also talked about the three capabilities that I went through with the demos of the new audit infrastructure to actually see what operations have been performed against your subscription, the new tagging capabilities, and the new RBAC capabilities. And we have a bunch of references out there. You can go on MSDN. All this is publicly documented for templates, for APIs, commandlets, and so on. We also have an MBA session. It's about 4 hours long. It goes from start to finish. By the end of it, you will do anything basically with Azure Resource Manager. And I'll kind of leave this up. Also, of course, you can always send an email to Gautam or myself or reach us on Twitter. But with that, hopefully we can have more open to questions. I know we kind of asked during the talk. But.
A quick question on the tags. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to enforce policy on their use? So, say, require that a particular tag have a value set for every resource that's created? Typically, when I'm using them in other environments, we find some people are lax, and it's then difficult to track down the user or the owner that you're supposed to be billing, a department or billing or whatever. Yep. Any thoughts on those lines yet?
Yeah, so we don't have that capability today, but that's definitely something that's in our backlog that we're working towards. Basically, ability to say, everyone must label the cost center on all my resources when they create it, or else fail it. Like that type of capabilities, yeah, that's absolutely on the roadmap.
And when you do that, linking the values that they can set for some of these tags to particular groups that are associated with a role they have, so they can't, you know, misassign it to a different department or similar.
So that probably is, I'd say, a little bit further out than just the basic ability, but definitely we'll take note of that. And I mean, it makes sense, basically.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
We're going to hang out here for a couple of more minutes. If you guys want to come by, ask a question and stuff, feel free to. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.